Enterprise Times podcast. My name's Ian Murphy. I'm here with Fred Lalulo, who's CEO of Aero Technologies and a former DJ in a previous life.
Long time ago.
Fred, how are you?
I'm good, thank you very much. Good to be here. You just said I was a DJ, but that was more than 30 years ago when I was in college. I'm Fred. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Aero. I've been working on this adventure for the last 8 years, but in a way, I've been working on this adventure for the last 30 years since I fell into the enterprise software adventure, working across all different flavors of analytics, from data modeling to BI to ERP to building Anaplan for many years prior to Aero. So it's been a long journey hitting the same nail, and I think getting some breakthrough right now.
Decision-making systems lend themselves naturally to things like AI because we've got so much data to deal with, so much complexity. But you started doing this long before we all started talking about AI and building your technologies along that line. What is the key technology that you put in place that's enabled you to get to where you are now?
The key is not one technology. The key is actually the ability to mix multiple technologies, including when you think about our engineering team, multiple teams coming from very different horizons. It's all analytics, but you have a lot of data processing, because if you want to digitize decisions, you need the 100% of the information that is required to make those decisions to be available in normalized data model in real time, or as close to real time as possible in the world of enterprise system. So there's one practice around data and analytics, really being able to process vast amount of transactional data, transform it, structure it. So that's one practice. The other one is a set of engines, including AI in multiple forms, from machine learning all the way to agentic today, to help project, predict, and allocate, do all the reasoning and all the math that is required when you're processing decisions. The next level is automation, the ability to write back and execute the decisions back into the transactional system. That's another practice. And the last but not least is the engagement. How do I engage with users with intelligent systems in real time, wherever they are? How do I democratize basically access to that intelligence? And for that, we built a whole new level of engagement, and we designed Aero as an agent since inception. That's why it's called Aero, like Siri or Alexa. We're talking years ago, we were doing demos of the system on the phone, engaging with voice back when we launched. So before agentic, it was already a thing, and that's fundamental. So what practices, just to recap, data and analytics, a whole set of engines from machine learning to agentic to multidimensional modeling, heuristics, the ability to automate decision, the workflow, the processing of all of that, and the engagement. So all these different practices coming together to deliver the automation of decisions.
I'd like to start with that data problem. For a lot of organizations, their data is scattered. It's a mix of structured and unstructured, where they have no real visibility of the unstructured data. They have duplication, they have some data that's of quality, some data that's of variable quality, they don't really know what state it's in. When you start with a client, they come to you and they say, this is our data map. How do you get them to understand the challenge of data quality and locating their data? Or is it simply a case of just pointing at the data and pulling it all in?
Multiple thoughts. The first one is you talked about structured versus unstructured. Until very recently, we were pretty much only working on structured data. And now with agents, we're able to work on unstructured data, which is wonderful. So it opens up decision intelligence to a whole new set of capabilities, from warranty management, claims management, everything that's triggered by an email, by a claims coming from one of your retailers. Just closing the topic on unstructured, it's now possible. It's now working a video. So agents can do miracle to understand unstructured data, and it's easy and cheap to do. When it comes to structured, it's better than it was. As I mentioned, I've been doing for a long time. Companies have made massive investment in cleaning up their ERP, their landscape. However, there is still intelligence that needs to be deployed to ensure that the data that you feed the decision intelligence engine with is not only complete, but it's coherent. I have a planner who keeps putting 20 for our lead time when the reality is on average has been 7. Well, I need to capture that. A normal system will say, well, I have a number, it's coherent, and I can work with it. But here, in the case of decision intelligence, because that number is going to trigger a decision, obviously, I need to ensure that the number has not been drifting. So we have developed, as part of our technology, some master data management capabilities that look at the data, understand it, and make adjustment when needed. We move from where is my data, deduplicating it, and all this kind of good stuff, which I think most companies have done a good job at. But whenever we start a project, the first thing we hear is our data is horrible. So we're used to that, but it's not difficult to manage. What I'm trying to explain is that we're taking it to the next level where it's not just about the completeness of the data, but it's about the quality, the intrinsic quality of the data, making sure the numbers make sense.
That quality, particularly around unstructured, becomes a challenge because you don't know what you're importing. So you have to start building data maps and a data fabric. How many customers end up saying to you, we don't know the state of our data fabric? Or they ask for advice on how to build a data fabric.
They ask for advice on how to build it. We've deliberately started our journey with larger organizations. In the world of CPG, life sciences, oil and gas, discrete manufacturing, they spend the last 20, 30 years deploying ERPs, moving from one version of an ERP to another. So over time, they're getting better. And the industries that we're operating in, the problem that you're talking about, they usually have a good understanding of their ontology. What they don't know is they don't have the level of refinement that I've just talked about. I'm sure that when we go outside those industries, maybe into others, we'll find more challenges. The key about decision intelligence is you don't need all the data. You just need the data that triggers decisions, that allows you to make decisions. So when you look at the entire scope, you say, okay, I need to make an inventory optimization skill that will deliver inventory optimization recommendation. Well, I need to make sure that my inventory subject area is actually clean, but I don't need everything else to be. When you start by looking at which decisions you want to make, which data you need, and you work on that perimeter of data, and gradually you expand.
That's very different to how most people assume they're going to work on their data. They don't say, what decisions am I going to make? They say, what data do I have? What will the data tell me? How do you change that mindset?
It's a good question. I don't know that we do change the mindset. People understand that you start with the decision, you start with the outcome, and you don't start with the data. The data is an enabler of a decision. The project's about the decision augmentation. Why do people do decision intelligence? Because they know that they don't make good enough decisions, fast enough, closer enough to the point of impact. That's fundamentally it. We make decisions that are not granular enough, not precise enough, and too slow. Or we miss a lot of decisions. We tackle two types of decisions. The decision that a company is currently making, as I just said, not fast enough, not accurately enough, not close enough to the point of impact. And they know that. They know because their on-time in full ratio is bad, because their inventory levels are off. They know why there is a problem. But there's a whole new set of decisions that are called born in digital that were not made before. If you think about media planning, digital media planning, and you connect that to your on-shelf availability. I'm going to talk about something that's real today that was inconceivable 10 years ago. If you're a large CPG company, consumer packaged good, majority of your media spend shifted from traditional advertising to online. Online means that you can activate or deactivate a campaign in a click. You couldn't do that when you were putting billboards out. You had to plan this campaign month in advance. You had to print the advertiser. You had to display it and do all this stuff. If you were doing a TV campaign, that's like a year long to work on. With digital, I can activate and deactivate, and I can control this at a pixel level. I can now correlate that to my on-shelf availability. Do I have the product available on the shelves? And is it right to advertise this on TikTok, on Twitch, or whatever, if I'm low on inventory? And vice versa, should I increase my campaign when I have excess inventory? Those kind of decisions are born in digital. You would not have conceived them just a few years back. These are decisions that require necessarily a digital system to make and execute those decisions.
But that also changes how people think. People are used to having time to plan. I have worked in delivering campaigns within the book industry. You're looking at what titles you might want. You're starting to look at what jackets you need to print, what stock levels you're comparing to previous years. It's a complex process. When we start to accelerate that process, it requires that everything comes together faster. It requires that people can make decisions faster. And that's not the case for a lot of organizations. One of the things you've got is you've got skills. and you term them skills, and they're built from pulling different bits of information together, but also in building out that whole decision tree. How do companies start with that? Because you began by giving them pre-built skills. Last year, you allowed them to start building and delivering their own without having to come back to you and say, hey, I want this. What's been the uptake by customers, and how have they understood what a skill is?
As much as I'd like to tell you that we help educate the market and we have helped, I think it's a natural realization that this is the next frontier. I'm thinking about a client in the United States right now working with ERA to reduce waste. It's an electronics manufacturer. We didn't tell them anything. They knew. We just enabled, with our technology, something that was already in the works. They were already thinking about. They were, in a way, dreaming about. But the point that you're making is so valid. The decisions and the executions have to tie. If you make a decision and you can't execute because your manufacturing system is not adapted, because your transportation system is not adapted, your decision is moot. That's why we talk about making and executing decisions. A lot of our customers today in that discussion are asking us to work on manufacturing, helping understand the IoT, the data coming in, and maybe adjust the manufacturing based on demand and on this kind of good stuff. The entire value chain is being synchronized as a much faster clock than ever before. And when I talk about value chain, I'm talking about the ecosystem within the four walls of the company, but also outside. We're doing a ton of work right now to help our customers work more effectively with their contract manufacturers. So the system now is helping make decisions and execution. I will come to you as a contract manufacturer. I'll say, hey, I need you to adjust this order. In real time, you need to come back to me and say, I can do it, I cannot do it. And that's the continuous adjustment that the system is making.
But that's a higher level set of complexity, isn't it? For most organizations, when we start to talk about optimization, when we start to talk about delivering automated processes, we are talking within the bounds of their control. You are talking about across the supply chain. That means you've got to be pointing in and out of everybody else's business. How much of a challenge is that for organizations?
It's evolving super fast. The relationship between the contract manufacturer, whether it's in life sciences or in electronics, they're pretty integrated. They work together very fast. The challenge is the decisions were not disconnected, so now they're connecting decisions. We're seeing right now, and we'll talk this afternoon at this conference, with Unilever, one of our great customers, who's now collaborating with the retailers on demand forecasting, where never done before. So they can jointly agree what the level of forecast is at the store SKU level based on sell-out data. And those are the level of collaboration that we didn't see before. The shift from supply chain to value chain is happening. The market is understanding that this level of collaboration is needed to be more efficient, to cut waste, to reduce the number of trucks on the road, to reduce the number of raw material that's not making it into the production. This whole economy around collaboration has moved so much in the last few years. Digital is breaking those boundaries, and the level of collaborations are definitely increasing.
When I look at the skills, one of the things that strikes me is that if we think about decisions, we tend to make them in isolation. Here's a decision, we make an action. Here's another decision, we make an action. When we look at agentic AI, we see people trying to make complex decisions using agents. But we've got to have a human in the loop all the time. You've taken your decisions where you've got ahead of this curve. You're chaining those decisions together to create this skill. And you've started with a human in the loop. But you talk about acceleration. And part of that acceleration that I've seen watching you has been removing that human in the loop as you've got to a trusted state with that decision. What do customers have to go through to be able to suspend that need to constantly be monitoring, to trust that set of decisions as a chain, not individual touch points?
There are two different questions in your question, I think. One is around human in the loop versus human out of the loop. What does it take to go to full automation? And the answer is either you have no choice or trust. But the first point is not to be neglected. You have no choice, meaning that I'm going back to my decisions born in digital. Humans can't take those decisions. They cannot. You could put 1,000 people behind computers trying to connect those dots in real time. We're not wired for this. So if you decide to tackle that problem of connecting the supply with the demand in real, you have to use computerized system. It's the necessity, because humans are not equipped to doing that. What the humans are really good at is guiding the system. And I got this machine, the machine does the work, the human guides how the machine does the work. So that's the necessity. In the area where the humans, the decisions are slower, there be more complex decision, it takes time to trust the system. So the system delivers the recommendations based on business rules and a set of parameters will either go in front of an operator for validation. Just like if I come to you with a recommendation, you're going to say, Fred, tell me why. Where is the data coming from? Did you think about this? Did you think about that? So that validation happens, and once it's happened 3 or 4 times, just like human to human, you trust me, I tell you we should do it, you say let's go. Because you don't have the time to validate every single decision. A manager today does not validate every single recommendation from the team. They build trust, and if I trust you, I'm going to go, if you say so, let's go. Now, I'll hold you accountable. I'll check that the recommendation was valid, and that's what's still happening. One part around automation is the necessity. The second part is building trust. What's happening is from the time we started to today, it's much faster to build that trust. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because people now walk into San Francisco and get into a self-driving car, a Waymo, and they just do it. We're trusting those machines more and more. It still require a bit of effort, but it's still happening. The trend toward letting go and letting the machines do the work is really accelerating right now.
5 years ago, if we'd been having this conversation, a lot of that trust would have been almost blind faith. The whole system was a black box. We didn't know what was going on. We couldn't get it to explain. There are a lot of manufacturers of AI systems out there who still think a black box is the correct way to go because explaining to the user is too complicated. When I've seen some demonstrations of how your skills work, you have the ability to let the user just continually drill down and down and down to see how that decision was arrived at. Part of that trust mechanism. Was that deliberate or was that just something that happened within engineering?
100% deliberate. The only part that you cannot really explain is when you're using an optimization algorithm. You put your parameters in and you see what's coming out. That's why I always recommend to our customers when they start to build that trust, to go after decisions that are high volume, medium complexity. You can leverage machine learning. You can leverage statistical forecasting and heuristics. You can do a lot of smart, complex stuff. But stay away from optimization in your first skill because users really will understand better. We've learned also how to build that trust, but the transparency of where the data is coming from, how the math is happening, is A, fully configurable by our customers, but B, deliberate on our side. We design it that way.
Continuous evolution of decisions is also critical because we get new data sources, we find new suppliers, new markets. We've got to be able to adjust. Your system does a degree of that. How many customers are allowing that continuous evolution as part of the trust mechanism? How many are still human in the loop and not yet quite hands-off to allow the machine to do that?
I'm smiling because the answer is it depends. We have customers in electronics right now, chip manufacturers. There's one famous one that we're doing a pilot with that works at what they call the speed of light. The speed at which they want to be able to modify the logic and around the scale is pretty much real time, and it's pushing us. Others are still thinking about a skill and a decision as something that you program and then you let run. I've got the full spectrum here, from real-time adjustments with massive pressure on flexibility to a little bit older school, like we're going to design the skill and we're going to let it run, and we don't touch it too often. But the trend is clearly going toward flexibility. You mentioned the word agent. We designed ERA as an agent, but we designed ERA as an agent before agentic was a thing. When we talk about an agent, we talk about a system that speaks with you in natural language, that understands what you want. Now, of course, we've embedded agentic capabilities that gives us more flexibility in terms of reasoning. And that's new. We are at the beginning of that. We are at the forefront of that revolution. Customers are very intrigued to see how what they used to configure in our software can now be replaced by agent intelligence, the reasoning part of the agentic capability. And that's the beginning. So when we meet next time, I'll tell you more how the adoption is working. We're doing some experimentation with it. Of course, the agentic part of ERA to look at unstructured data, as we said before, and transform it to structured, engage with the people in natural language, write an email back to a supplier, all that is almost mundane. It's happening all the time. I'm talking about the decision logic, having teams of agents connecting in real time and adjusting the way decisions are being made. That is really the let go. That's the hands off. That's the trusting the machine. And that's just, we're at the beginning of that.
One of those challenges of moving to a decision-making system for organizations is decisions are processes. They know what the process is. They know how the job's supposed to be done. They know what's supposed to be looked at and what's got to be assessed and what the analytics will be, and then the decision at the end of the day.
Can I correct that?
Yeah, by all means.
It's also full of biases. If there were just a process as you describe, it would be easy. The challenge that companies have is that they think that decisions are a straightforward process. They think that they can map the way decisions are made. They've written rule books about it. They've structured that into software. They've trained people. They've put some controls. And yet, when a problem happens and you have to allocate a limited inventory across multiple suppliers, the operator is likely to do it based on biases. And this is not following a process. And that's where it gets really interesting. Because the number one pitfall in decision intelligence when a company starts on the journey is that they actually think that they know how decisions are being made. And they don't really.
Because it will be that person who's taking the order.
Exactly.
Who says, I've got 10,000 units, but I've got 50,000 in. I know that customer will pay quickly. I know that customer's in a market we want to get into, and they will divert it. How do you remove bias then? Because whenever we build a system, it is incredibly hard to remove the bias of the individual, the bias of the underlying process. How do you make this remove bias without introducing new bias?
This is the shift that we see toward more automation, where clients are now realizing that every time they let the humans in the loop or on the loop, they're introducing biases and the performance gets degraded. We're starting to have enough data now to be able to say that when you allow people to intervene in a decision-making process and go against the machine recommendation, you degrade the performance of the decision. Not on every topic, but it's starting to really show. It's a change management process from the companies. We don't do much. We provide a technology that allows you to see that, to acknowledge that, but it's change management. And usually, change comes from desperation. It's a near-death experience that's going to drive you to make more radical changes. If you give people the choice, you're going to move very slowly. We're seeing more and more companies saying, we have to move toward digital. We don't have a choice, and we're going to do it quickly.
How do you change that mindset for many of them who've started out with, I've got this system come along. It's now making decisions, which is changing my internal processes. I need it to now tell me what my process should be. Because that's what's happened in other fields. The speed with which software is developed now, that is running faster than we would ever think about creating a process. So people are naturally going to want to codify what that decision making is so that they can still call it a process. Are you seeing customers abandoning what has been our way of dealing with things for thousands of years and now just going, nope, we're all about the decision?
I'm going to say not yet. But part of my presentation this afternoon at our user conference here is about the fact that for the first time, I see agentic AI as replacing the reasoning. What you're talking about is reasoning. A decision is a combination of, I need the data, I need guidance, but there's reasoning. We've never digitized the reasoning. When the decisions were structured means that they're following a set of, if there is a stockout, I have four options. ERA, go analyze the different options, and based on outcome, this is a fairly simple structured process. You can do it at scale, deliver massive value. But here we're talking about deploying much more dynamic and fluid reasoning. We're at the beginning of that. Have I seen companies make changes? No. We're at the very beginning, but it's happening. So I think we will. I think it will happen. But the leap of faith that is going to be required to let the machine run on its own a different reasoning that might be completely counterintuitive to what the humans have been trained to do, I don't know. We'll see how that goes.
How will that play with regulators? There's a very famous IBM quote from about 30, 40 years ago that runs something along the lines of, a machine must never make a decision because a machine is never responsible. If we look at regulators, regulators still want some responsibility. They want to understand how it got there so that it doesn't break laws, it doesn't cut corners, it doesn't disadvantage certain groups of people. How do we persuade regulators that there is good in this? It's not just trying to be nervous.
It will depend by industry. You're working with a utility or a financial services, it will be very different than if you're working with a manufacturing company that's deploying decision intelligence to help improve stock levels and stuff of that nature. It will depend by industry. The key for us is to keep the human in full control of what the machine is doing. So what we're believing is that if this is part of the software we're releasing, we have the control room allows. And our customers are literally building that. The same way they build digital control room for their network, their factories, we're now allowing them to do this for their supply chain using decision intelligence so that they can see in real time the data flowing into the decisions being made, the decision being created, so to speak, by agents, by functions. So you're in full control, and we're putting monitoring capabilities, alerting capabilities, we're putting boundaries. Or if a recommendation comes out of certain boundaries, then you can stop it. So you have to put controls. That's a whole process. That's quite complex. The guidance will then be with the regulators. Look, these are the controls that we're putting. This is how we stop things from drifting. This is how we're monitoring and controlling the process. The very interesting counter-argument to that is people make tens of thousands of decisions in a company every week, every month, and you don't control every single one of them. The machines are providing more control, more ability to monitor and to act based on what they're doing than humans. Humans keep things for themselves. Humans have secrets. Humans have biases. Machines don't. They're completely transparent. That's a new debate that's coming in, and we'll see how that goes. You're asking the super smart questions around biases. Again, this will be a question of, it's not because humans are not good at it that we should admit that the machines can be not perfect. I remember a conversation with the CEO of a large CPG company, and us and their leadership team and the whole team was like, what happens if the machine makes the wrong decision? And the CEO said, we make tens of thousands of decisions. We don't know if they're all good. They're probably all pretty bad. But in aggregate, we're performing the way we want. What the machines are giving you is full transparency.
There's an interesting challenge with that learning, isn't there? And you and I have had this discussion to some degree before. A lot of companies are pouring all of their data, all of the historical data, into building their AI and automated decision systems. The problem is, all of that data contains all of the mistakes, all of the things that are no longer relevant, all of the things you would never do today. There's a need to curate what you give it. You want it to learn from good decisions. You don't want it to learn from your bad decisions. How much awareness is there in the market at the moment that they do need to curate what they're feeding it if they want to get good decisions out? Because really, they want a positive feedback loop. They don't want something that's just suddenly going to amplify a decision that will take the company down.
It's a fair argument. It's a fair point. The level of maturity is pretty high. The devil is always going to be in the detail. For example, you're looking at demand forecasting. You have data. Then you start running the algorithms and you realize that some things are out of whack. Well, why is it out of whack? Because you were planning to run a promotion at a specific time, but this retailer did not run it. It's not in the data. It's in the facts. Or vice versa. The retailer ran a promotion and it wasn't planned. So you didn't have this. So the ability to analyze and get better with that data, get more deep understanding of what's been influencing the data, is something that we see our customers now do all the time. In the past, they didn't really care. But now they really need to understand every incident, every event that influences the data that will then improve the quality of the decisions.
I think that's interesting to hear because historically, I've seen people do the after-the-event report, but learning from that report is often very patchy in organizations. If they're now using that and using that to tune in a positive way and pick things up, that's a significant jump forward.
The maturity is increasing quite a bit. Those are real examples that I've just shared with you. And I've been 30 years in the world of analytics, and maturity has really increased. And now the level of quality of understanding of what influences the data that then triggers the decision-making processes automatically is quite remarkable. Not every industry. I can't talk about every industry, but we're seeing it really improving quite a bit.
I'm looking forward to what you're going to tell us later, Fred. Thank you for talking with me.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks for having me.